The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. And we'll begin with China Takes the World into Uncharted Waters. Twice in the 20th century, Japan challenged the West, first in a military-led attempt to become an imperial power, and then as an industrial powerhouse. Now it is China's turn to take the global stage. 75 years ago after Japan's surrender in World War II, and 30 years after its economic bubble popped, the emergence of a 21st century Asian power is shaking up the status quo. As Japan did, China is butting heads with the established Western powers, which increasingly see its growing economic and military prowess as a threat. In turn, China, again like Japan, feels the West is trying to limit its rise, fueling nationalistic sentiment among both its public and leaders. What's changed, though, is the global landscape. Post-colonial to start in one of nuclear-armed states, global institutions, and much deeper economic interdependence. China's goals are similar to Japan's, to assert control in its immediate neighborhood while securing resources for its economic growth. But its means are different. Rather than imposing direct control through armed invasion, China is relying on economic enticements, cultural outreach, and a gradual buildup of its military forces to boost its standing. The means by which China would increase its power are vastly different, as are the means by which other countries might resist it, said Jennifer Lin, an Asia expert at Dartmouth University. The rest of Asia is watching with a mixture of opportunism and trepidation, eager to benefit from China's trade and investment, wary of its size and strength, and its sprawling territorial claims. Much larger than Japan, with 10 times the population, it is potentially better able to go toe-to-toe with an established superpower. China's Belt and Road Initiative is building ports, railways, and other infrastructure across not just Asia but also Africa and elsewhere in the developing world. Less welcome is China's growing presence in the South China Sea, where it chases away the fishing boats of its Southeast Asian neighbors and has built artificial islands to stake out its territorial claims. Raymond Navaratnam lived through Japan's World War II occupation of Malaysia as a boy. The veteran commentator advises working with China, not against it. "We must be able to win them over," he said. "In other words, live peacefully with the dragon. Don't antagonize it." In a different era, when the sun never set on the British Empire, a rising Japan sought to join the League of European Colonial Powers by invading and occupying China and several Southeast Asian nations, often in brutal fashion. Japan formally surrendered 75 years ago. This week on board the USS Missouri, its empire-building ambitions in tatters, after U.S. atomic bombs leveled two cities, ushering in the nuclear age. China leaders marked the anniversary Thursday in a brief and solemn ceremony at a memorial hall that remembers those who fought the Japanese. Rana Miter, an Oxford University scholar and author of a book on the Japanese invasion of China, cautions against comparisons between then and now. The age of classic empires is over, he said. Tomorrow's disputes will be about economics and technology, both civilian and military. Reading history is useful and necessary, but it is not a guide to the future. Foreshadowing those disputes, Japan tussled with trade partners from France to the U.S. as it rebuilt itself into the world's second largest economy after World War II. Japanese made cars, steel, and consumer electronics were blamed for rising unemployment in the industrial West. As those frictions peaked in the 1980s, China was experimenting with market-style reforms. Four decades later, Japan remains wealthy but has stagnated, while China is now the number two economy and the one embroiled in a trade war with the United States. Again, similar to Japan, China is accused of stealing technology and falling short on promises to open its own markets as it strives to become a global competitor in industries from electric cars to advanced medical equipment. More fundamentally, China's ruling Communist Party fears that its one-party system will never be accepted by the West, said Richard Haydarian, a Philippine analyst who has written extensively about the U.S.-China rivalry in the Pacific. That generates the sense that no matter what they do, the West will always see them as a threat and seek to contain or sabotage China's rise, he said. Take the Belt and Road Initiative, which has reached America's backyard in Latin America and is viewed by the West as a gambit to increase Chinese influence overseas. Or the South China Sea, where U.S. Navy aircraft carriers push back against China, which in turn feels encircled by U.S. military bases from South Korea to Guam. Ultimately, the most significant legacy of the war in Asia is the lasting imprint of U.S. power, both military and economic, said former American diplomat Mintaro Oba. It's unclear how their differences will play out in the 21st century environment. That both China and the U.S. can threaten each other with nuclear arms puts at least a partial check on any thoughts of going to war. The greater risk is that the world's two largest militaries get drawn into limited conflict, perhaps inadvertently, over an issue such as Taiwan, the self-governing island that China claims as its territory and the U.S. supplies with arms. Economically, the U.S. and some others are pressing companies to reduce their reliance on China. The Trump administration is putting curbs on Chinese tech companies, from telecom giant Huawei to the high popular TikTok video app, and leaning on its allies to do the same. But for many, breaking up with China's efficient factories and huge consumer market would be difficult and costly. China assembles most of the world's smartphones, personal computers, and other electronics for Apple, Dell, and other brands. Its growing market is critical to foreign automakers and other industries when American and European demand is flat. There was just no way that Japan could match the United States, even in the Pacific, Haydarian said, where China is quite different in that its sheer size gives it increasing parity with the United States in ways that Japan never enjoyed. That makes China, military conflict or not, a potentially more formidable challenger in the years to come. Next, child care crisis pushes U.S. mothers out of labor force. Angela Nguyen had just launched her own project management business, hitting a career stride after years of struggle that began with earning an undergraduate degree as a single mother. Then the coronavirus pandemic hit, forcing many schools to shift online. The now mother of five saw little choice but to give up her newly minted business to help three of her children cope with remote learning while her husband, the primary breadwinner, kept his job at a senior living center. To see all that come to fruition, I did it, but now it's gone, said Nguyen, who has always been the main caretaker for her children, ages 1, 5, 11, 12, and 18. But my priority is my kids, and their education is everything. Nguyen's story is becoming distressingly common. Research is increasingly pointing to a retreat of working mothers from the U.S. labor force as the pandemic leaves parents with few child care options and the added burden of navigating distance learning. The trend threatens the financial stability of families in the near term. In the long term, the crisis could stall, if not reverse, decades of hard-fought gains by working women who are still far from achieving labor force parity with men. Thousands of school districts are starting the school year with remote instruction, including most of the largest ones. At least half of the country's child care providers are closed and may not survive the crisis without financial help to cope with implementing safety standards and reduced enrollment. In August, the federal jobs reports show that women in their prime earning years, 25 to 54, were dropping out of the workforce more than other age groups. About 77% of women in that age group were working or looking for work in February, compared to 74.9% in August. The decline is most pronounced among black women of that age range, whose participation rate is down 5 percentage points since February, compared to 4 percentage points for Hispanic women and 2 percentage points for white women. Overall, the drop translates into 1.3 million women exiting the labor force since February. We think this reflects the growing child care crisis. BNP Paribas economists Daniel Ahn and Steven Weinberg wrote in a recent report, "It is hard to see this abating soon, and if anything, could become worse as we move into fall. Few families can afford for mothers not to work indefinitely. Mothers are now equal, primary, or sole earners in 40% of U.S. families, up from 11% in 1960, according to federal labor figures. Women also comprise nearly half the U.S. labor force. For Anna Hamilton and her husband, juggling two careers while raising two children was always a bit of a house of cards. The pandemic knocked it down, at least for now. Hamilton, who lives in the Atlanta area, is taking indefinite leave from her job at a small investment firm, a job she's stuck with for 12 years in part because it allowed her family to move twice so her family could pursue his career as a cancer surgeon. She has mixed feelings, but one thing she knows is that working full-time while handling remote schooling last spring was unbearable. There was a lot of yelling. I thought, let's just admit what's happening, and maybe everyone will be happier, said Hamilton, 43. I hope it's not a career ender. And next, some see opportunity in coming wave of vacancies. The pandemic is expected to drastically reshape commercial real estate, leaving thousands of vacant and underused spaces nationwide. but some developers and investors are keen to seize the chance to convert those properties into other uses. Lord & Taylor's flagship department store in Manhattan, for example, will soon house office workers for Amazon, and a tourist destination in the heart of Hollywood is getting a $100 million facelift that includes converting underused retail spaces into offices. Nobody ever lets a crisis get in the way of creating opportunity, said Sheila Boating of Avison Young, a commercial real estate services firm in Toronto, where she is president of the professional services practice for the Americas. Conversion waves in the past were often localized. For instance, more than 13.8 million square feet in Lower Manhattan changed over after the September 11th terrorist attacks in 2001, according to the Alliance for Downtown New York. But those shifts were nothing on the scale that is expected in the next 18 to 24 months, experts say. In retail alone, at least 7,700 stores totaling 115 million square feet were expected to close this year as of early August, according to data provided by CoStar Advisory Services. Most of these closures will be in malls, which were struggling long before the pandemic pushed department stores like JCPenney and Neiman Marcus into bankruptcy. At the same time, 172.7 million square feet of Class A office space, typically the highest quality, is expected to come online this year and next. Only 59% of it has been leased, below the average of 74%, according to the CoStar data. And nearly one in four hotels nationwide faces possible foreclosure as owners fall behind at least a month on loans, the American Hotels and Lodging Association said. Simply put, a lot more space is going to be available out there. If there was a sudden drop in demand for Cheerios, General Mills would just pull the Cheerios, said Victor Kenilog, head of commercial real estate economics at Moody's Analytics. Then there's going to be less and prices won't have to fall as much. But once you've built an office building, you can't exactly take it off the market. Some of the causes of the national oversupply in commercial real estate predate the pandemic. For example, the shift to e-commerce has hastened many stores to the grave in recent years. More than 10,200 stores closed in 2019, according to CoStar. Also, businesses that use offices have been pulling back on space amid rising digitization and other efficiencies, as well as demographic shifts. Younger generations in general are comfortable with less office space. The commercial real estate industry's rule of thumb in the 1980s was 200 to 300 square feet per employee, according to Moody's Analytics. By 2019, the average had fallen to 126.5. And industries as diverse as real estate, media, technology, and banking have been flirting with more telecommuting for decades. Moreover, a sizable chunk of leased space goes largely unused during the workday anyway. Estimates place it at 30 to 40% as people are out of the office for various reasons. But the crisis has created a chance for some developers to reassess their strategy. I think for the real estate community, this represents a moment in time to think about current assets, how they're being used, and what future options might be, Boating said. The starkest example yet of this approach might be Amazon's possible plans to convert JCPenney and Sears stores in shopping centers owned by mall operator Simon Property Group into distribution warehouses. which was reported earlier by the Wall Street Journal. The e-commerce giant is also behind the overhaul of the shuttered Lord & Taylor store on Fifth Avenue, turning 676,000 square feet into office space for about 2,000 employees by 2023. Amazon declined to comment for this article. Last month, DJM Capital Partners, a real estate services firm and private equity firm, Gaw Capital Partners, revealed plans to overhaul the Hollywood and Highland, a Hollywood entertainment complex on the same block as the Dolby Theater, which hosts the Academy Awards. Those plans call for carving nearly 100,000 square feet of creative office space out of existing retail. When the firms bought the complex last year, they had a low opinion of the future of the traditional brick-and-mortar real estate, said Sten Parton, chief retail officer of DJM. Then the coronavirus shut down thousands of businesses across the country. If anything, I think it solidified our business plan as we've seen the record store closures as a result of the pandemic, he said. Most conversions won't be as grand. Instead, they'll involve smaller and less heralded properties. Still, a wide variety of conversion projects is expected. Developers see an opportunity in converting hotels into continuing care retirement communities, said David Reese, chief executive of Senior Care Development in Harrison, New York. It's less expensive to convert a property than build from the ground up, especially in expensive markets such as New York. If you can buy space for the equivalent of 50 cents on the dollar less than new construction, then you're clearly going to be fine when you do a conversion, Reese said. Nationally, new residential construction generally averages $225 to $350 a square foot, compared with $150 to $200 for an office-to-residential conversion, according to a report provided by project management firm Cumming. For industrial construction, the average new project costs $125 to $250 a square foot, but that can fall to $75 to $175 for a retail-to-industrial switch. Despite the potential for lower cost and the emerging universe of options, commercial real estate conversions do pose challenges. Zoning and technical design can stymie some changeovers. And it can be more difficult to draw financing for conversions during the pandemic when lenders are more averse to risk. Core and stabilized assets are drawing financing opportunities, said Eric Rosenthal, a co-founder of Machine Investment Group, a real estate investment firm. Transition stories are when there's an element of execution beyond just buying it and managing the property. The environment to finance those assets is very challenging. Traditionally, the best conversions have increasingly been obsolete properties. Typically, if they're older and they've gone beyond their useful life, reduced occupancy, reduced cash flow, they are ripe for transformation, Botting of Avison Young said. But even newer properties are on the table. Neiman Marcus opened a 188,000-square-foot flagship store at Manhattan's Hudson Yards just last year as the anchor retail tenant in the nation's largest private real estate development. Now the related company's owner of Hudson Yards is pivoting. Felipe Weiser, president of Related Office Development, said by email that the store would become the most exciting office opportunity in New York City. The move harks to previous crises that forced a metamorphosis in commercial real estate. In the 1990s, Lower Manhattan was racked by high office vacancies and population drain. And William C. Rudin, president of New York landlord Rudin Management, helped lead efforts to rejuvenate the area. More than 4.6 million square feet was converted from 1995 to 2001, including glassy office buildings no one thought would make decent apartments. When things get bad enough, Rudin said, it forces people to come together and come up with ideas. And next, Hallmark casting for movies in Wilmington and Charlotte. If you can muster some winter holiday spirit at the tail end of this hot and humid summer, you have a chance to be immortalized in one of the great traditions of our time, the Hallmark Christmas movie. North Carolina has two Hallmark movies filming here this fall, one in Wilmington and another in Charlotte. According to casting agency TW Cast and Recruit, extras are needed in Wilmington next week for filming of a Hallmark movie called USS Christmas. Casting for a second unnamed Hallmark Christmas movie has been taking place in Charlotte, according to the Tanya B. Dahlquist casting Fat Cooper. The North Carolina Film Office lists no current productions in the state, but there is a note on the site saying that productions are resuming. We don't have a lot of plot detailed, but a Facebook post last week by the Patriots Point Naval and Maritime Museum in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, indicates that the USS Christmas movie, apparently being shot in the Charleston area and in Wilmington, will take place at least in part aboard an aircraft carrier. Now, what would make a better movie plot than Christmas aboard an aircraft carrier? This fall, Hallmark will film one of their famous holiday flicks aboard our USS Yorktown. Get casting details at the southerncastingcall.com. There is no indication of who the film stars might be, but WWAY-TV in Wilmington noted that actor Trevor Donovan posted on Twitter that he's working in Wilmington in September with actress Jen Lilly. Donovan is known for his part on 90210, but has also starred on a number of Hallmark movies, including Nostalgic Christmas, Snow Coming, Love, Fall, and Order, and Runaway Romance, and Marry Me at Christmas. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.